Thank you. It's actually delightful to be here and on this beautiful campus. Let me start. After talking to Bob, I realized I had to really talk about food crisis. It's a question of what we mean by it, but I won't get into terminological issues. I'll just go right to Malthus, because I think the ghost of Malthus is stalking late capitalism. And we see it in the public presentation, the media presentation of the idea of a food crisis. Here's just a couple of examples from The Economist and Newsweek. The idea is that scarcity remains, even though it seemed to have gone away for a long time, but it does actually remain, and the number of hungry in the world, in each country, and in the world as a whole, is growing even as the primary prices of food, which spurred this media interest in crisis, like the prices of oil, have actually plummeted. But there's a lingering sense that food is scarce, like oil, and that they're becoming scarcer even though prices are falling and going through their fluctuations, increasingly, of course, together in tandem. As an example of this kind of Malthusian view, which I don't diminish in any way, Lester Brown has been carrying this idea from the Earth Policy Institute for a long time. From his new book, he says, as land and water become scarce, competition for these vital resources intensifies within societies, particularly between the wealthy and those who are poor and dispossessed. The shrinkage of life-supporting resources per person that comes with population growth is threatening to drop the living standards of millions of people below the survival level, leading to potentially unmanageable social tensions. So, let me give you my argument in a nutshell, and then I'm going to go through it and show you some nice pictures, too. First, we need to update the population question. We need to think biologically and ecologically in order to update this. Instead of linear projections, we need to be able to think about ecological contexts and relationships. The new population problem, I will argue, and I hope you'll be convinced by the end of this, is one of population biology or population ecology. That is, the dynamics of species populations and how these populations interact with ecosystems and the biosphere. That's the first step. The second step, this requires us to rethink food. Specifically, livestock and crops and the industrial raw materials necessary to produce them industrially displace other species and change ecosystem dynamics and the totality of life on Earth. This includes intense fossil fuel dependency of industrial agricultural systems, production of large quantities of greenhouse gases, both carbon dioxide and, in particular, methane, which is I noticed in the Los Angeles Times yesterday that there the very alarming discovery of methane bubbles and melting polar ice caps. But that is something that's happening. The other thing that's happening is that methane is being produced in massive quantities by cows being fed things that are inappropriate for their digestion. Some food, or food produced in some ways, therefore, here we go, becomes part of the population numerator rather than the resources dynamic denominator. So it's not that the crops and livestock are our food and will there be enough food for humans. It is that we increase the numbers of certain small number of species that are our food crops, and we produce them in a certain way that we have to understand the population as all of those species in relation to our way of producing. So we can the third step of the argument, we can rethink crisis in a useful way by considering the mode of consumption together with the mode of production, something that's been brought to us by the French Regulation School, at least to me. And this can lead us to some very interesting ways to conceive of positive exits from the present crisis of population and resources. So that's the argument I hope you'll find convincing by the end. So let me start with a little brief excursus on Malthus. Now, for Malthus, the main critique in the 19th century that most of us, I used, and probably Bob and people who read Marx a lot, is that the scarcity had to do with pressure on employment. And that the relation between population and resources was really one between employment and resources, and it had to do with cycles, and therefore the creation of a reserve army of labor that would be hired again in another cycle. This is all very well, perhaps, up to a point, and that is the point where material limits are reached, and that's where we get to ecological limits. There's just not going to be enough stuff, you know, peak oil, minerals, and land, water, soil, to produce more stuff, to hire more people who are now populating the slums and being evicted massively from the remaining peasant farming systems of the earth. Maybe there can be more services. Maybe everyone can be a website designer and a massage therapist, and maybe we have enough people with money who can hire them. But more likely, I think, the planet of slums is going to be the end of the line with no sufficient employment possible resolution in that way. But the more important question for me now, today, is Malthus Redux, what is food? Now, in 1729, Jonathan Swift wrote in A Modest Proposal the suggestion that the population food problem be solved, especially for the Irish, that the impoverished Irish might sell their children to the English for food, and that would solve everybody's problem. I think this anticipated a way of thinking that we really need to take seriously about the relationship that we have to what we eat, the interspecies relationship, to extend it beyond humans and to understand the complexities of our relationships to animals and plants that we grow and those that we displace. Yeah. So, today there is apparent abundance. Since the last food crisis that was named in 1973-74, the official progressive line on food security, the mantra has been, there is plenty of food, it's all about redistribution. And some redistribution would be a good thing. However, in this food crisis, the media is full of another true thing, which is that about a fearful projections that masses of consumers who want to eat the way that North Americans do are emerging in the global south, particularly in China and India, and that particularly the most important thing they want to eat that is so fear-inducing is meat, and that shelves like this will and are actually appearing all over the world. So, they are. Now, this meatification of diets is a phrase, as are most of these very high-tech slides, from Tony Weiss, a geographer at the University of Western Ontario, and someone I've been working with who very kindly gave me a lot more slides than I'm showing you, and I hope I can keep up with the technology. His term is meatification of global diets. As you can see, world meat production has increased about 5 times since, I forget when it was, since 1961, right. Okay. A lot, all right. It's increased a lot, and it's still growing. It's now 37% of by value of gross agricultural production, and per capita, the kilograms per person has been soaring as well. Now, of course, it's uneven, and that's what leaves so much fearful room for growth in the so-called developing world, where it's only 30 kilograms per person, and it's at the moment 80 kilograms per person in the so-called developed world, both projected to grow. Now, as this has happened, the kind of meat has become simplified, and there are really three meats three that are displacing all the multiple livestock and wild animals, that are grown in various farming systems still around the world. And so now it's basically cattle, pigs, and chickens. So these are grown increasingly not in anything that resembles old MacDonald's farm and not in relation to crop production directly, but in what are called confined animal feeding operations, or CAFOs. Okay, there's an example of chickens and some more chickens. Most people don't think of these kinds of things as farms anymore. So once upon a time, improving landlords, we had a slide up, and scientific farming of the 18th century, like most mixed farming systems around the world, were ecologically organized. So animals provided energy and fertilizer, and so did human waste. This is not true only of Asia, it was also true of Europe. Animals still fulfill those functions in most farming systems in what are considered to be backward parts of the global south. So, with industrialization of agriculture, the animals eventually came to be put in these industrial CAFOs. The crops, of course, became concentrated in monocultural fields, and those got reduced in number for the economically significant ones and the ones that take up significant amount of land area and industrial inputs, so that maize, rice, and wheat have become basically the three cereals that are significant economically in the world. The animals are increasingly eating these, and you can track world meat production in relation to, let me go backwards, world, oh, I didn't mean to do that. Sorry. I can't keep those on at the same time. But world soybean production, which has been growing commercially in the West, first in North America, then in Brazil, is almost completely devoted to the feeding of animals. The animals are treated themselves as machines. There are two conversion rates that are attempted to be, the technology is devoted to increasing. One is the reproduction rate of the animals, so that the annual number of animals per year does not reflect how many animals are actually slaughtered. I'll have a slide on that in a minute. They reproduce much more quickly, and by the way, one kind of gendered perspective on this that couldn't help but notice for years now is that every innovation in animal reproduction for livestock purposes winds up being used for humans at some point. But in particular, artificial insemination and embryo transplants. The second conversion rate that is relevant to the feed crops more directly is the conversion of feed into flesh. And as a result of some very good, I've gotten off my slides here. In the late 19th century, the global chicken population was approximately 100 million, as far as we can estimate, like who knows, right? Today, there are 50 billion chickens killed annually.
Did you go to those 2 years ago? 100 million in what year?
At the end of the 19th century. In the U.S., more chickens are killed in one day than were killed all year in 1930. Okay. This, in my view, is the new population problem. It's about the quality of life and ethics for humans and all the dependent creatures that we bring into being to serve only as human feed, and it's about the displacement of self-organizing ecosystems of beings that we call wild, by contrast. So, once we do that, once we've got massive fields of maize and soy, which are dominating the landscape of what are called the breadbaskets of North America and other parts of the world, they're easy to convert to any other use. So, as soon as it's profitable to produce biofuels, that's where they'll go. But I think it's an intrinsic feature of this system. And it becomes part of the psychology of farming, too. The first time I encountered biofuels as, or agrofuels as a new phenomenon, I was in England and I met socially a very large English farmer who had just returned from a program that had been organized by the Common Agricultural Policy of Europe on biofuels. And he said to me, oh, you know, no problem. Farmers are worried about profits and no problem. We're all going to be producing fuel. There's going to be an energy shortage. We're going to be just fine. And I said, oh, well, who's going to produce the food? And he said, oh, I never thought of that. There we go. So, agriculture has changed from an anchor of societies, states, and cultures to a tenuous component of corporate global sourcing strategies. That's a quote from Philip McMichael, someone with whom I work a lot. From Richard Levin's "The Shortest Possible Economic History of Agriculture During the 20th Century" would be this: non-farmers learning how to make money from farming. The ecological effects of this kind of farming include what Vandana Shiva calls peak soil, depletion and pollution of water, the nitrogen runoff that flows down the Mississippi and has created a gigantic dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico is because the natural fertilizers that are being produced by these massive quantities of livestock cannot be effectively applied to the land. And it is more profitable to use industrially produced fossil fuel-based nitrogen fertilizers and mined phosphates to apply to these fields instead. They run off into our waters and have massive ecological consequences. The animals themselves have big effects on climate change. The head of the IPCC announced in 2008, I want to highlight the fact that among the options for mitigating climate change, changing diets is something one should consider, and in particular, eat less meat. Agriculture accounts, in some calculations, for 18% of anthropogenic global greenhouse gases, a large share of which is from animal agriculture. And the standing joke, at least in Canada, among climate change people is about animal emissions. And it is a joke, but on the other hand, it's true. And in New Zealand, they started to fine farmers who feed their animals grains instead of pasturing them because of the methane that's produced. The main cause of these anthropogenic greenhouse gases is clearing forested land for livestock. Of course, the Amazon is the most famous for that. The production and transport of fertilizer used by farm vehicles, and of course, animal emissions. Now, this insight has come slowly, since agriculture has been relegated to the margins of theory, policy, and public attention, since industry mesmerized our species. Socialist as well as capitalist imaginations have not taken agriculture seriously, except as something to be industrialized, and then not very seriously at that. But finally, there is an emerging understanding that agriculture is the point of intersection of many, many of our unmanageable problems, from impasse at the World Trade Organization to loss of biodiversity, ask me about it in the question period, to the massive wave of evictions of the remaining peasants from the soil, which Aragi calls the global enclosure of the peasantry. All of this is what is producing this planet of slums that Mike Davis has written about and I think spoken here about, which again is hard to envision as a reserve army of labor eventually to be absorbed into a global working class. So to put it simply, grain to feed cattle could feed 10 people, grain to feed pigs could feed 5 people, and grain to feed chickens could feed 3 people. But it's way more complicated than becoming vegetarians, though that might shake up the system, but then it might not either. So those are the one estimate of the ratios. There are different ones. Francis Moore LePay, who was on this way back in the 60s, calls intensive livestock operations reverse protein factories, that instead of eating up the food chain, we're eating down the food chain and using massive amounts of resources as a result. So these are the kinds of production systems and landscapes that we create when we simplify, when capitalist agriculture and industrial agriculture simplifies and standardizes the conditions of agricultural production. We have massive loss of landscape to urban so-called development. Challenge I'm putting out to the world, let's find a better word for development, because it's mostly not, but it's really hard to find another word. So protecting farmland is a crucial thing. Cities were mostly built in the best farmland and then proceeded to pave it over. It's not a great moment of our species intelligencers. Kurt Vonnegut would say our big brains. So we produce these really devastated, polluted, mechanical systems. And at the same time, the dominant policy direction that is proposed at every level of scale, particularly globally, by both by private capital and by international organizations at this point, is to have more of the same. That fertilizer use that has been increasing in all countries, sub-Saharan Africa remains a virgin outpost. It could increase its productivity by having more industrial inputs, just like the rest of the world. And that is, in fact, where a lot of the attention of philanthropy like Gates, and policy, the World Bank's intention to differentiate remaining farmers into those that are commercially viable and the others who should leave the land, all of that fits exactly a replication of this model in the one part of the world where it is still hasn't happened. These agrochemicals are major industrial sectors, and in fact, agriculture, I think, should be seen now through mergers and acquisitions and the actual corporate interconnections that have come to exist. Agriculture should be seen as a branch of the chemical industry. And it is deeply related to pharmaceuticals, and because of genetic technologies, all of these together are at the leading edge of technical innovation for profitability at this moment. So there is an integrated chemical, pharmaceutical, agricultural sector, and all the politics surrounding the different technologies, which I'd be happy to talk about in the question period, relate to this conveyance or conflation of power. So, to just pick up on the World Bank development report, because Bob asked me about that when we were having a conversation before, the latest World Development Report is once again on Africa. It's not Africa, it's on agriculture. It's been quite a long time since the World Bank focused attention on agriculture. And if you read its policy recommendations, that is where it points, that get big or get out, which was the simplified language of a former U.S. Department of Agriculture, Secretary of Agriculture, directed to U.S. farmers, that remains the mantra in other parts of the world. That big, in this case, means contracting with buyers. And who are the buyers now, particularly fresh fruits and vegetables and fish for privileged consumers, so far concentrated in the north, but with growing numbers, growing absolute numbers in various parts of the world, particularly in Asia. So what happens is a couple of things. One is that farmers in Kenya are encouraged to grow petit pois, or fresh-cut flowers for, according to very specific standards, the Walmart grader will show up to check the standards if he or she shows up. If not, you're stuck. The farmer is stuck with their products, and these will enter into highly controlled transnational fresh chilled supply chains to wind up in supermarkets, which have become the dominant corporate actor relative to food manufacturers who still remain large. The other piece is that the growth in fish and seafood consumption and the commercialization of production of those systems have brought to the waters of the world, both the seas and the large freshwater systems, the same kind of ecosystem transformation and simplification that has been happening on the land for many, many centuries. So aquaculture becomes a major pressure on wild fish populations in addition to direct catches, and it becomes a major pressure on sustainability of marine and freshwater ecosystems. Okay, so all of this has been organized by increasingly large, concentrated, and technically dynamic corporations that mainly integrate seeds, animal pharmaceuticals, and agrochemicals. Most of you probably know, but it bears repeating, that these large concentrations of animals are great disease generators. And for this reason, more antibiotics are actually used prophylactically in confined animal feeding operations than are directly given to humans. So the massive problem of antibiotic resistance or bacterial resistance to our drugs is has been created in large part by the system of animal production and is completely dependent on it. So that was an early link to the pharmaceutical corporations, and then there have been much more direct links to the agrochemicals, particularly through genetic technologies. So the top 10 TNCs have a percent share of global commercial markets of seeds, 50%, animal pharmaceuticals, 55%, and agrochemicals, 84%. There's a list of some of the names that you've probably heard of, but may not have put together. You may not have put Monsanto and Cargill together, although they are very closely implicated, BASF, DuPont, Syngenta. And a lot of this is being organized through what I think is the main political field of contestation now, which is control over knowledge. So even though the World Trade Organization, I believe, has reached an impasse in further development, particularly around agriculture and agricultural subsidies, which I can't talk about now, but they're a very big part of this problem, that even though it may have reached an impasse, the introduction of TRIPS, the Trade-Related Intellectual Property Rules, is crucial, and it is firm, and it is there. And it is the way that corporations are gaining control over the very seeds of our food system. So there are many things to say about this. One is a genetic simplification story. Another is a chemical dependence story, because that is the profitable way to breed them. It's certainly not the only way, arguably not the best way. It certainly enhances their control relative to all other actors in the system, particularly farmers. Now, while the poor farmers of the South, and everywhere indeed, are being encouraged to grow the crops that are going to enter into these transnational supply chains for relatively privileged consumers in the North, and sometimes absolutely privileged as well, the industrial food system is not going away. What we're getting is a dual food system, one for the rich and one for the poor, both of them increasingly globalized, both in their sourcing and in their distribution. Supermarkets are taking over from local food markets and making access by local farmers to local consumers difficult all over the global South. At the same time, as people are evicted from the land and have to increasingly enter globalized food markets for their food, this is what's offered to them. It is the kind of industrially edible commodity that is basically composed of those three big grains of maize, soy, and to some extent wheat. Recomposed, deconstituted, reconstituted, and then all the chemicals from several plants in New Jersey, literally, Michael Schlosser documented, going in to enhance their flavor, their texture, and so on, and then multiple packaging, which makes it all appear very diverse. This is what's on offer increasingly for the poor who are still in markets, and of course many cannot enter markets at all and no longer are losing access to local food markets, and local farmers are being pressed at the same time. So here are a few of the things on offer. Oh, I love this slide. So there's one of our kind of conglomerates. Here's another one. Let's see if we can get this one going. So there appears to be a lot of diversity, but basically it is not. So I hope I've convinced you that the Malthusian equation should be revised in light of population ecology. And now I'm going to get to my third point, which is that a different future may be emerging in the interstices of the present system. And there are many ways to talk about this. I'll start not with this, with an article that many of you may have seen, as I did in the New York Times a week ago, that the present Secretary of Agriculture wants to start counting as farms, because they don't in the statistics, the most rapidly growing set of agricultural production units, which are small farms, which are based on part-time farming, on mixed occupations. It seems like a David and Goliath story, you know, a couple of lesbians with the goats who go to the farmer's market and sell their goat cheese, and like, what's that got to do with Kraft and Nestle? And, you know, in the evening, they're farmers in the morning, and they're government officials, maybe conservation people in the afternoon, and there are web designers in the evening. Now, you know, the idiocy of the countryside, all of that stuff we inherited from the 19th century, that's over. That's people want to move back to the countryside. The question is, what's going to happen to the farmland? And will it be farmed in a way that is sustainable? Now, that's in the north. And apparently this administration is looking in that direction to say, yes, this is the most dynamic. There is no reason why this can't be a really happy future where agriculture is done in a way that is actually sustainable and is enlivening for people who have diverse lives, who have cosmopolitan lives, who are connected by the internet, who can get a cappuccino in every small town, right? Whatever it is that the reviving community theater, whatever it is that is that has made the depopulation and the devastation of culture in the countryside what it has been for so many years, that's all changing, and it's changing without help from anybody. And people increasingly want to leave the cities, and they want to be gentlemen, gentlewomen, I guess, farmers too. They want to be this, they want to be that, and increasingly there's an ecological awareness and a local food awareness that this has to happen. Now, the good news, that's part of the good news, it's happening even without help, and that there may be help forthcoming, maybe, if we all pay attention and work toward that. The very good news is that even though the remaining peasantries and sustainable farming systems in the global south are being rapidly undone, they do have a lot of what we need, and it's time to learn from them, and it's time to have a new partnership between formal science, site-specific ecosystem, and practical knowledge. I hope you'll have something to add in here. So it was a very great privilege into which I was drawn kicking and screaming. It looked so impossible when I was asked to do this. International Assessment of Agricultural Knowledge science, knowledge, that's actually not its real name, it's ISTAT, International Assessment of Agricultural Science and Technology for Development, which is a name that only a committee could have written for a bureau composed of governments, corporations, civil society organizations. But it is in a sequence. It's an evolving institution of the expert assessment that began with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And this one was headed by Robert Watson from that. And formerly, at the time he began this, he was chief scientist of the World Bank. Before that, Clinton science advisor at the time that, of course, Gore was vice president. And as the climate change science politics has evolved, it's become clear that agriculture is a major part of the problem and that it is absolutely necessary for the solution. That humans have to eat, we have to interfere with the earth in order to eat, that the way we do it will make all the difference to the survival of ourselves and other species, that we can do it in a way that sequesters carbon, that restores ecosystem integrity, and that provides food in a sustainable way for human populations. So the question is how, and the institution was the expert assessment. There have been other expert assessments since climate change. It's an institution worth looking into. There was the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. There was a biodiversity assessment. There was an ozone assessment. And now there's an assessment of agricultural science and technology. And that's the website. I can't encourage you too strongly to check out that website, www.agassessment.org. Now, the key thing, people who are attentive and who can read and listen at the same time, unlike me, may have noticed that I didn't use the word knowledge when speaking, even though it was written there before. That was a political triumph right at the beginning, to get the word knowledge in. Because knowledge meant more than science, formal science, and more than technology, the application of formal science. Knowledge means indigenous knowledge, practical knowledge, ecosystem knowledge, site-specific knowledge, place-specific knowledge, and culture-specific knowledge. So once it was all in the pot, there was a question of what kinds of bureaucratic language, AKST, agricultural knowledge, science, and technology, would best promote, here's the mandate of the report, 400 experts, 3 years, sustainable agroecosystems, including management of natural resources, sequestration of carbon, and so on, enhancement of rural livelihoods, reverse the expulsion of people from the land, actually enhance the ability of farmers in all parts of the world to become more knowledgeable, to enhance their knowledge through a different partnership with formal science, and to increase rather than decrease their skills, and, of course, to provide food security for all people. That is, equitable access to culturally appropriate and healthy food and adequate supply. So site-specific knowledge, oh, I got ahead of myself. How do I go back? There. Site-specific knowledge was key, farmers' knowledge, partnerships with formal science, a different agenda for science than that has been dictated by corporate interests, mainly to increase tolerance to herbicides and to put pesticides directly in the plants, those are the two main genetic modifications that have been introduced. They both come out of profit agendas. They both intensify the problems of industrial agriculture with respect to its ecosystem effect. So a different orientation using ecological sciences, which are themselves reaching immense maturity. They've been around for more than a century and have been applied to agriculture by farmers and by formal scientists. So a new partnership with local farming systems and formal science. And there are many ways to do this in terms of who's located where, who does what, who decides on research agendas. Democracy and empowerment are a big part of this story. Another part related to TRIPS is to have open access for biological technologies and biological discoveries. Richard Jefferson is another website I didn't write here, but I will tell you, bios.org, B-I-O-S.org. He was one of the pioneers of genetic technologies in agriculture, American, but now based in Australia, and is convinced that the intellectual property regime that has come into place is inhibiting scientific research. He loves science, and he wants open access. And he started a site where if enough places put their innovations and their knowledge onto that site, rather like Linux, I think, not that I understand it very well, could be a tipping point and make the property regime redundant. The person who's looking into this, thank the goddess, is Jack Poppenberg at the University of Wisconsin, who began understanding the commodification of the seed, hybridization as an early phase of genetic technologies as they have actually been introduced in practice, and understanding the sociology of science and agriculture in a very profound way. And Jack's working on this now. Yes. So look for it and check out his website. Farmers need to have breeding rights in some way so that innovation that takes place in a practical way can be, benefits of that can be captured. There has to be massive public investment. All of these are findings of the report that I'm putting in my own words. There has to be massive public investment, which is almost completely dried up or been captured by private investment in agricultural research. So to have a public agenda is the first phase in having a democratic way of setting a research agenda. And there have to be some kinds of incentives for food production to be done in a way that not only is sustainable and not only reduces the negative impacts of agriculture on the earth, but actually enhances ecosystem integrity and, in the ecological economics language, provides environmental services. So restoring waterways, soil integrity, reduction of greenhouse gases and sequestration of carbon from other sectors, all of these, reduction of fossil fuel use, both for production and for shipping the food around the world, all of these are real strengths that need to be encouraged by political and economic systems. And there are some existing policies that start to anticipate this. Now, most treatments of multifunctionality, which is embraced in this report, most treatments treat it as a trade issue, that the Europeans introduced the idea that agriculture has multiple functions, some of which should be paid for and all of which should be protected, and major exporters, including the United States and Canada, have opposed this on the grounds that it's actually a restraint on trade. But take it out of that. It's simply true, whatever its effects, it is simply true that agriculture has multiple effects beyond food production. And you can talk about full cost accounting and making ecologically damaging farming systems pay, but it's much more interesting and much more forward looking to think about how to reward people who both produce food and environmental services, landscape services, all kinds of things. And it also embraces some of the ideas that have been coming out of the food movements that I'm going to leave for Raj, particularly food sovereignty. So all this stuff is happening. It's not just made up in a report. It's happening in the interstices, demand for organics. Yes, it's gone industrial, but people understand. It's a public health issue. It's an environmental issue. It's an individual health issue, especially for Americans. The slow food movement is not just a fancy supper club. I recommend that you look for the Slow Food Foundation on Biodiversity and look at where they held their last meeting, which was in Puebla, Mexico, where the ability of indigenous farmers to maintain their continual enhancement and assistance to maize varieties to adapt to increasingly changing climate is being threatened, and that the ability of markets to help these farmers get access to local consumers or local consumers who want to be able to support local farmers to maintain agrobiodiversity all those things are being undermined, and the whole slow food movement is to relink those things based on educated pleasure, educated appreciation of the importance of food to the ecosystem and to the cultures of people. There's increasing awareness of food miles. Increasingly, local food is becoming interesting to people and in demand, and that's what's supporting some of these rapidly increasing small things that hardly count as farms but are growing a lot of food. There's rising concern about climate change. Fair trade is growing. It's kind of getting into the supermarkets for good and for ill. Those are tensions I think we can talk about. Direct relations to farmers, not only through farmers markets, but through community shared agriculture, that some of the resistance that's been around for a long time to factory farming is now being appreciated as more than eco-terrorism. And there is an animal welfare and animal ethics movement that's being understood by more people, more about animal rights and vegetarianism. And here's the part, you know, Carlo Petrini of Slow Food compares himself to José Bové, a leader of the resistance to genetic crops and in general to the foods and a pioneer of the food sovereignty movement as well. He contrasts himself to that, and the language I like to use is that of warriors and builders, that everybody's part of some way of changing things, but that the civil disobedience is actually transforming through slow food, through a variety of other movements, into something much that's starting to emerge into consciousness as something much more positive, to actually build local food movements that are interconnected, parallel to and integrated with energy transformations. So, not to forget about workers, very important, because a lot of local food is very exploitative through migrant workers, and particularly through illegal workers, and in Canada, through complicated arrangements of state-to-state relations for migrant workers to come and work in the greenhouses around Toronto. The MST in Brazil, struggles for land, which are crucial. Protecting farmland around cities is crucial. Farmers' organizations, many of them linked in the food sovereignty movement. So the question is, are these fragments or the cusp of an anti-systemic movement? I would say even a positive transformational movement. In a book that I would recommend to you by Murdoch Marsden and three M's, also starts with an M. It's called Worlds of Food, published by Rutledge, I believe. They refer to all of these food movements. There's so many of them, from farmers, from eaters, from public health, which is really getting into this in a big way, environmental movements, animal movements, all of these together are arguably the largest social movement in the world. Now, they're not organized as a coherent movement, but they're increasingly in touch with each other, and there are increasingly umbrella terms like multifunctionality and food sovereignty that sound very abstract, but actually are links among people and are in conjunction with one another generating a new vision of how we might live on this earth as food getters and as eaters. So, I want to thank Tony Weiss. That's the reference to his book, The Global Food Economy, The Battle for the Future of Farming, from Zed, published in 2007. And these are wonderful slides, and I've learned a lot from him and enjoyed working with him. So, thank you for your attention, and I'll look forward to the questions.
Thank you very much, Alex.